BBC.
BBC.
I'm Edward Sturton. Welcome to Politics UK at the end of an unprecedented week in British electoral history. It was the first full week of campaigning, and it reached a climax with an event unprecedented in British politics. A live televised debate between the leaders of the three main parties. The Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, the Conservative leader, David Cameron, and Nick Clegg of the Liberal Democrats spent an hour and a half on their feet in front of an audience of 200 voters answering questions about Home Affairs. We'll have a full report on the debate in a moment, but the week began more conventionally with the launch of the party manifestos. Our political correspondent, Sean Curran, reports on what they are offering.
It's a great British tradition that the political parties announce their election promises with a fanfare and as much razzmatazz as they can muster. Most voters usually respond by not reading a word of them. Come May the 7th, Gordon Brown doesn't want to have a garden shed full of unread manifestos that he can't shift for love nor money. And so Labour hit upon the cunning wheeze of printing a mere 2,500 copies.
For those who say the promises made at elections never come to pass, I just look round at this new building, a new acute NHS hospital that will be open within weeks, a modern building that embodies the timeless ideals of compassion in action. Look at what together we have built. We didn't just fix the roof, we built the entire hospital.
And, of course, empty hospitals aren't full of sick people making the place look untidy or angry relatives unhappy about their treatment. Labour's manifesto promises that income tax rates won't go up and says public services like health and education will be protected. The next day, the Conservatives launched their election platform at a disused power plant in South London, where David Cameron urged voters to join him in governing the country.
So it's not time for more big government. It is time for the big society. The big society is a society where people ask not who's going to make things better, but how can we together make things better?
He may have read most of it, but not even David Cameron or his would-be Chancellor George Osborne know the manifesto off by heart.
What it says on green taxes is we do want to raise the share of overall taxation taken by green taxes. I haven't got the page reference, but maybe George can think of it while I'm answering the rest of your question. Always like to challenge people.
I'll come back to him.
He'll come back to you.
The Liberal Democrats may be the third largest party at Westminster, but they have the biggest political star in the shape of their finance spokesman, Vince Cable.
Thank you. I have basically one point to make, but it's a major one. And the point is that we take the economy seriously. We take the government deficit seriously. That's the elephant in the room. The elephant was banished yesterday and the day before at the Labour and the Tory press launches. We don't think you can banish it. We have to confront it. And I guess I'm the elephant man.
The elephant in the Liberal Democrat room is their desire for a hung parliament where they can wield real influence.
OK, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the campaign launch and the manifesto launch of the UK Independence Party.
UKIP's big policy is still that the UK should leave the European Union. They're promising an edgy campaign and lots of surprises. Their leader, Malcolm Pearson, isn't allowed to stand or vote in the election because he's a member of the House of Lords. That's not the surprise, by the way. The shock announcement was that UKIP would campaign for some candidates from other parties if they were Eurosceptic enough. Greens may be a force to reckon with across Europe, but they've yet to win a seat at Westminster. The Green Party is promising substantial rises in taxation and public spending. But at least they'll be able to recycle their manifesto after the election.
Sean Curran reporting. Some of those themes were, of course, picked up in Thursday night's live televised debate between the main party leaders, the first of three debates in this campaign and the first of its kind in British history. The debate audience had been selected to be broadly representative of Britain, and the rules of engagement had been tightly drawn. Too tightly, some said. The audience was forbidden to applaud at any point apart from the beginning and the end. This first debate took place in the city of Manchester in northwest England. The focus was on Home Affairs, and the moderator was Alistair Stewart.
Manchester, in the heart of the northwest of England, is tonight host to a British political first.
Despite the whizzy game show style, much of the debate was focused on pretty detailed policy. There was the odd flash of a sharpened sword, the odd flash of humour too. During a section on Law and Order, Gordon Brown joked about the Tory posters, which carry his own mugshot on a vast scale.
I'm grateful, by the way, for David, for you putting up all these posters about me and about crime and about everything else. You know, there's no newspaper editor done as much for me in the last 2 years because my face is smiling on these posters.
David Cameron!
Thank you. Well, let me take on very directly this question of money and public spending, because I think it's going to be a common feature right through these debates about how do we fund the public services that we need. And I think it's really important we start focusing on what we get out of the money that we put in. Because if we think that the future is just spending more and more money, we're profoundly wrong.
But the issue here is, will you continue to fund the police?
Yes, of course. But Gordon, let me give you an example.
Will you match our funding on the police? The answer is no from your manifesto.
Let me give you a very good example.
This is not question time.
Let Ms. Cameron answer your point, Mr. Brown.
It's answer time, David.
What matters is what comes out. I went to a Hull police station the other day. They had five different police cars, and they were just about to buy a £73,000 Lexus. There's money that could be saved to get the police on the front line.
I'm just slightly surprised that there's any discussion between you two going on about what money you can put into public services. Because I read your manifestos this week. In neither of them are you coming clean with people about how anything costs, because you haven't got any figures in your manifestos. We've set out very clearly not only what we will do, but how we will pay for it.
Mr. Cameron, you can only pay for things these days
if you're prepared to save money
Mr.
elsewhere.
Cameron. On that point, let me take Nick back to his manifesto and one pledge that's in there that worried me a lot. My mother was a magistrate in Newbury for 30 years. She sat on the bench and she did use those short prison sentences that you're talking about. And I've got to tell you, when someone smashes up the bus stop, when someone repeatedly breaks the law, when someone's found fighting on a Friday or Saturday night, as a magistrate, you've got to have that power for a short prison sentence when you've tried all the other remedies. And the idea that you never send someone to prison...
David Brown, on that point, please.
That's why there are 20,000 more people in prison as a result of the tougher sentence we've been passing. But you've got to answer this question. We will continue to match the funding of the police as of now. You are saying you're going to cut it. Now, be honest with the public, because you can't airbrush your policies, even although you can airbrush your posters.
In one sentence, Mr. Cameron.
Gordon Brown is trying to make you believe he can protect health spending, he can protect education spending, he can protect police spending. He cannot do any of these things because he's given this country the biggest budget deficit of any developed country in the world.
Afterwards, I asked Sean Curran which of the candidates looked most like the next Prime Minister.
Well, strange though it may seem, Nick Clegg, the Liberal Democrat leader, came across as somebody who was very assertive and was able, even though he's the leader of the third largest party at Westminster, to punch his weight. And he looked like an equal when he was there. There were times when Gordon Brown did have that advantage of incumbency, when some of the things he said had force because he was talking as Prime Minister. It has to be said, though, David Cameron did seem comfortable in this environment. So perhaps if television was going to be the deciding factor, David Cameron would have an edge.
But crucial, that point for Nick Clegg, wasn't it? Not least because he was up there, it appeared, as an equal with the other two.
Absolutely. Lots of people at Westminster were frankly amazed when Labour and the Conservatives agreed to have these debates and have them with Nick Clegg up there. And I think a lot of people were looking to him at the beginning to see what sort of start he would make. He came across as quite confident. He was very good at making use of the television techniques, responding to the audience, remembering the names of the people who were asking the questions. He didn't come across as somebody who was a junior partner. I would think that will worry the other two parties.
In terms of the substance, lots of disagreement, of course, but not much sense of a really big argument going on.
No, actually, for a lot of the time, there wasn't much of an argument at all. We learned, amazingly, that all three parties think the police force is a good thing and crime is a bad thing. They all agree that immigration is a problem and they all think that education is really something that everybody should have. This was real motherhood and apple pie stuff for a lot of the time. When they did have arguments, what we saw, again, very surprisingly, was both David Cameron and Gordon Brown at times stressing how much they agreed with Nick Clegg, making an obvious grab, really, for his voters, I thought. But we never got from any of them what we were rather expecting to get, which was the big message and the big vision. And it was interesting that this debate on domestic affairs didn't produce them using this as the opportunity to spell out their big message.
In terms of the electoral impact, is it too crude to say that if Nick Clegg did well, it makes a hung parliament more likely?
Lots of people are talking about a hung parliament. I think if Nick Clegg had made a big gaffe, then maybe we would have seen him being dismissed. The fact that they went to such efforts to love bomb him in the slang and to make that grab for his voters means clearly the two big parties are worried about a hung parliament.
Sean Curran again. The debate took place against an undercurrent of concern in Britain about social problems like binge drinking and family breakdown. And in the run-up to the campaign, David Cameron talked a great deal about what he called broken Britain. Mr Cameron has tried to shake his party free of the socially conservative image it once had. But there is a prominent place in the party's manifesto for one traditional institution, marriage. The Conservatives would give a tax break to married couples when one of them decides to stay at home. Britain is in a relatively small minority among the world's richer countries in not recognising marriage in the tax system. I discuss the background to the party's social policy with Matthew Taylor, who was head of the Downing Street Policy Unit under Tony Blair and is now the chief executive of the Royal Society of Arts. Madeline Bunting, a columnist on The Guardian and the author of a recent book called The Plot, and Brenda Armand, Emeritus Professor of Moral and Social Philosophy at Hull University and the author of the book The Fragmenting Family. I asked Professor Armand whether she thought marriage should be promoted by the state.
Well, I think the important thing about marriage is that it's an institution, a social institution. Too often people think, if they're comparing marriage with cohabitation, they're thinking it's just about which way two people want to go about their lives. But in fact, it's a broader thing than that. The society we've got was built on something like marriage. Maybe it's had various forms and permutations, but it's not entirely a matter for individuals. It's something that society has set up, particularly for procreative reasons.
So your answer to the question would be yes, because marriage isn't just about private choice, it's about public good.
That's right. What sort of society do we want to live in? And what sort of foundations do we need for any society which we might want to live in?
Matthew Taylor, same question to you. Is marriage something that the state should support?
Yes, actually. But I think it should encourage it and support it without incentivising it. I think it's when the state starts to incentivise marriage that it gets into difficulties.
Madeline Bunting, same basic question to you about whether the state should be promoting, supporting, even incentivising marriage.
It's interesting, Ed, because I noticed that the verb you used shifted from Brenda's question to Matthew's. So promoting is one thing, supporting is slightly different. And again, it's interesting how the language shifts between marriage and long-term relationships, because actually people are choosing to withdraw from that sort of public institutional notion of marriage, but they may well be opting for a very long-term cohabiting relationship, which we would see as probably just as conducive to the well-being of the children, which is, of course, the primary issue at stake here. Long-term relationships are crucial to stability, emotional stability and security of children. I think everybody agrees on that. Whether it's a marriage or a cohabitating relationship seems to me to be not significant. And the state clearly can support long-term relationships.
It's interesting you make a distinction between marriage as a private relationship and marriage as an institution. And Professor Armand was arguing that it's its institutional character that makes it suitable for government intervention.
The distinction, I think, is that marriage is an institution and cohabitating relationships do not have that social institutional framework. Now, does the state promote the public institution of marriage? I think this is where you're just not going to make much headway against very broad social changes, which find all forms of institutional life and the kind of currency of social recognition problematic. And so I think that's putting your eggs in the wrong basket.
Would you like to address that, Professor Armand?
Yes. The question is, how is the state supposed to promote or support long-term relationships without finding some way to distinguish a spot on a whole continuum of the way people choose to live together? There are plenty of people who are choosing cohabitation as not wishing to commit themselves for a long-term future. And true, there are some people who see it as quite the equivalent of marriage, and so they don't feel they need it. But when you've built a system of pensions and recognition for couples with children, then you do actually need some way for the administration to decide which people are going to be eligible for what.
Just a second, Matthew. I just want to ask Professor Allen to address Matthew Taylor's distinction between... Yes, exactly. What do you make of that?
We're a long way from the point where we could be talking about incentivising people. That is because of the financial situation of the country at the moment. What I think Cameron is working at is more negative than that. We've developed a system of a couple penalty, as people like to call it. And there are plenty of think tanks and so on which have done research on this and putting out figures very carefully worked out as to how much it costs a couple to live together as married and how much if they were not married. And we've drifted into a situation where you actually have a penalty for being married. Right.
So that, Matthew Taylor, means that at the moment we are disincentivising people from getting married rather than that we're now moving to a situation or may move to a situation where we're incentivising them.
Well, there are a set of kind of difficult issues you look at in policy making, and this marriage question has this problem about the distinction between a correlation and a cause. Is it that there is simply a correlation between people who are inclined to stay with each other and therefore get married, or is it that when people get married, it somehow makes it more likely that they're going to stay together? Almost impossible to disentangle that.
But is there not evidence that if you are married, your children are likely to do better than they would if you're simply living together?
There is evidence that long-term relationships are better than alternatives. And there's also evidence that people who are married are more likely to stick it out. That's absolutely true. But it's also true that the difference between people who stay together and split apart largely seems to be to do with the way in which people split up. So if people split up in a reasonably kind of amicable way and divide responsibility, if fathers continue to stay involved with their children, for example, then actually the effects are much smaller. The real problem comes, the really big impact on life chances comes when people split up and the father disappears.
Quick final word on that before we move on to slightly broader questions, Professor Armand.
Just looking at figures, say, for whether a couple are more likely to stay together till the child is five, and there's an enormous difference between the expectation if they're married and if they're simply cohabiting. There's been the long-term drop in marrying, but still the figures are there. So that suggests that it's not a matter of going in for this cause versus correlation argument.
Well, what you have just said leads us on to the broader question of whether there is a link between what we've just been discussing and the bigger question of whether we have a broken Britain in terms of teenage pregnancies, binge drinking, all those very in-your-face, if you'll forgive the phrase, social problems. You, I think, think there is.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we're really talking about girls who are still at school and are young teenagers. In the case of the teenage pregnancies, you've got to look at the benefit system. And it's undoubtedly the case that for some people, it is so much more advantageous to have a child without a partner in your early teens that people are making that as a positive choice.
What do you think, Matthew? Do you think there is a link between the areas we've been talking about?
I'm kind of with Boris Johnson on this. I don't think the Broken Britain thesis is particularly helpful. Generally speaking, in most ways, life is getting better. People live longer, they are healthier, they are better educated. There are three different sets of issues which are subsumed in this idea of broken Britain, and I don't think they're usefully subsumed because they are all different. One is a set of issues around people who are at the margins of society, the very poorest. The second is around the kind of behaviour of people who've got money but who choose to kind of drink a lot or who are suffering from anxiety. There's a kind of set of things about the modern condition, all the whole debate about why is it that as we get richer we don't seem to be getting happier. And then thirdly, there's a debate about migration and about the way in which our places are changing as a consequence of migration. And I think Broken Britain thesis pulls all those things together in a great kind of visceral mush.
Much of Matthew's analysis I'm very sympathetic to. This area of sort of etiquette, binge drinking, road rage, a certain sense of aggressiveness on the street. I mean, one of the things that I think is really significant here is the way expectations of women's behaviour has really changed. And I think that prompts a real sense of discomfort, that some people are very, very unhappy about what they see as a real sort of significant change in the way women behave, because I think women used to have a restraining impact on certain types of socialising, and now it's clearly not the case.
Professor Armand.
Yes, the reason I didn't get straight from the teenage pregnancies to Broken Britain is because I think we've got so many different hairs we're running here at the same time. There's the issue of the youngsters' behaviour. There's the issue of parts of the country which are not the city centres but these big estates where actually virtually nobody is married. There are no men who live in houses regularly. And there are masses of children of one mother and another father. There's that issue. Then you raised the issue of family breakdown. Well, that affects all levels of society, and that's about divorce and about divorce law. And it's also about the expectation people don't have so much nowadays, that they've committed themselves. And that's the other reason why marriage is a good institution, because although I agree from the point you made much earlier, there can be reasons for divorce, which we have to accept. But on the whole, it's used to be better for people to say, well, I don't expect it to be marvellous, but I'm committing myself to it. So that's a different issue altogether from then these random crowds in the city centres who have mixed age, not just teenagers, and creating mayhem, as you say.
So just to be clear, I mean, Matthew Taylor talks about this problem very much, correct me if I'm wrong, but as if it is something which involves social levers, things like affluence and relative success in some ways. But you think there is a strong moral component at work here. Is that a fair...?
Well, I do think that you're better off living in a community where loads of people are married and have been so for
but
a long
I think
time.
The most interesting evidence I've seen about the rise of single parents is about the decline of blue-collar manufacturing jobs. That the biggest driver of why women, at the end of the day, have thought, I'd rather bring up my child on my own, is because they haven't actually had a man who's been bringing in the wage. So there are very, very sort of significant economic factors that impact on marriage. You know, the idea that this is, you know, individual moral decisions and we've somehow become morally degenerate is something that I would really resist.
You've all made the point that this is quite a complicated bundle of issues. I forget who it was who used that phrase. Do you think it is something that can usefully and helpfully be discussed in the context of an election campaign? I mean, because it's broken Britain has become such a phrase, because we have these Tory policies on marriage, are we going to have an intelligent and helpful conversation?
I'm not opposed to encouraging more people to stay in long-term relationships. I'm not opposed to, indeed, I've been very much in favour of encouraging people to show better manners towards each other, all sorts of things, which are jolly good. As I become older, these things matter to me more. But if we're going to have those, there are certain things that will come with it. So let's, for proper debate, account the kind of choices that we've got as a society, rather than politicians telling us that we can have all the good things that we want and none of the bad things.
Madeline.
I'm just intrigued that we haven't actually heard much about broken Britain from the Tories. They've shifted tack onto the big society. And now what they're talking about is we the people and we're going to take charge of the country, etc. So actually the whole broken Britain thing, I think, is over now. We've had that argument.
Brendan Armand.
Yes, well, we might have different ideas about what should be talked about during an election. But the fact is, when interviewers go around the country, the first thing people want to talk about, if they're living in certain neighbourhoods, is crime. So when are we going to talk about these issues, if not at election time?
Professor Brenda Armand ending that discussion. The general election is, of course, about the serious business of power, but it's also one of those great British events, like Ascot or the Henley Regatta, which combines the excitement of a race with the opportunity for sartorial commentary. The papers have had a good deal to say about the contrasting style of the party leaders, and even more to say about the styles favoured by their wives. The Prime Minister's wife Sarah and the Tory leader's wife Samantha have been very visible during the campaign to date. Eleanor Goodman has been covering elections since the 1970s, and she told me the level of interest in the leaders' spouses does seem to be much higher than it was in the days when people like Jim Callaghan and Harold Wilson were Prime Minister.
I think it's partly a reflection of just in what poor standing politicians are held, and anything you can do to help improve your image, you'll do it. And to some extent, if you can show a beautiful wife, it shows there is a non-political dimension to you. The whole role of women was very different in, say, Mary Wilson's time or Audrey Callaghan's time, though I discovered to my horror when I went on the net that poor Audrey Callaghan, who was wife of Jim Callaghan and loyally went along beside him, but she was known as the Yorkshire Pudding. I mean, can you imagine? I don't think even today's press would do that. And then you saw it happening with Cherie Blair, who became more political. And also you have these numerous outlets, these these social networks and things and twittering, which they can go on and which weren't available at the last election.
Outlets and outfits. There seems an extraordinary focus on exactly what everyone's wearing, right down to the labels and the prices and everything.
Well, personally, I find it absolutely horrendous that it once makes me want to rip up the papers. The idea that your vote is going to be dictated by who can get the best bargain at Primark or wherever.
I suppose if we're going to give this a bit of historical perspective, we should remember that there was, of course, one famous consort who was not a wife but a husband.
Indeed, Dennis Thatcher. That was my first election campaign on the stump in 1979. And his role was sort of part consort, part sheepdog. He used to go around urging her to get a move on. I remember that very famous shot of her nursing the calf in 1979 when she went down the farm. And Dennis sort of turned to me and snapped at me and said, "If she holds it any longer, she'll throttle it. It'll be dead." And another time, all the journalistic written hacks had rebelled at being sort of extras to the television media and insisted on having a little session with her on her own in her hotel bedroom, which actually, curiously enough, she seemed to quite enjoy. It was late at night and she was sipping a glass of whiskey, several glasses of whiskey. And Dennis started saying, "Come to bed, Margaret, dear, come to bed." And she was saying, "No, no, no, I don't want to. I'm enjoying this," because she was having a good argument. So his role was to sort of keep her on the rails.
To what extent do you think the increased focus on the spouses reflects a change in the role of the Prime Minister's spouse? The idea of a First Lady is a very American one, but perhaps as people talk about the Prime Minister's job becoming more presidential, there's a change in his or her spouse's role too.
You're right. The focus on the wives is in part because we are going down a more presidential route. But I don't think you're going to get to the point, as you did with Hillary Clinton, where you saw the president's wife actually making policy. If you remember, Cherie Blair had to back off, rather, when people thought she was behaving too like Hillary and it became a charge against her that she was going to run Tony Blair like Hillary ran Bill Clinton.
And finally, how much difference do you think it actually makes to people in terms of the way they vote?
I hope it makes absolutely zilch difference.
Eleanor Goodman. That's all from Politics UK this week. Our editors were Elaine Thomas and Mari Jessel. I'm Edward Sturton. Things should begin to cook nicely as everyone gets into campaigning stride over the next few days. So do join the programme again next week.